Hello, I'm Bex, and welcome to the Week Junior Show. Today, I'm joined by three of the team from the Week Junior, the magazine making sense of the world for 8 to 14-year-olds. We've got Group Art Director Dave.
Hello.
Managing Editor Vanessa.
Hello.
And Features Editor Ben.
Hello.
This week, we'll be talking about a discovery that changed history, some inspirational award winners, and a fantastic flock of flamingos. Plus, we'll have a debate all about watching the TV with subtitles. But before all of that, given our debate topic, I want to know what was everyone's favourite childhood TV show? Dave, you can go first.
Well, I'm a bit of a nerd. I'm very proud of it. I've always loved science fiction. The show I'd always get most excited about was, no, not Doctor Who, but a show called Blake 7. I'll keep this brief so I don't get booed off the podcast, but essentially Blake and six of his chums find and take over an advanced alien spacecraft piloted by a talking computer called Zen. And they spend every episode running around the galaxy dodging an evil federation that are out to get them. There's always an evil federation somewhere, isn't there? I think it's brilliant. It's quite dark, oppressive, and felt as though it could be real, unlike any other sci-fi at the time.
Wow, you've made me want to go and watch it, Dave. Vanessa, how about you?
Well, I haven't got an essay prepared for mine. I just really liked Grange Hill. That was my favourite. I just got really engaged with all the characters. I just thought it was fantastic.
Grange Hill's a great shout. Ben, what do you have to go against Grange Hill and Blake 7?
Mine is The A-Team, which was an action show in the 1980s, and it was pretty stupid, to be honest. It was just four guys driving around in a really cool van, helping people, but somehow building tanks out of cardboard boxes and then blowing things up, although no one ever got hurt. Really stupid stuff, and I absolutely loved it.
Interesting. Three very different choices. I've gone for Blue Peter. It's a classic. And I used to absolutely love it. I'd try and make all the stuff on there, and I would always fail entirely, but still. I also want to know what everyone's favourite fact from this week is as well. So, Dave, what is yours?
Well, my favourite fact is that Richard Garriott has become the first person to travel to Earth's four extremes. He's already been to the North Pole, South Pole, on October the 12th, 2008. Richard flew aboard the Soyuz TMA-13 mission to the International Space Station as a private astronaut, returning 12 days later. On the 1st of March, he reached the deepest known point of the sea, 11,000 metres below the Pacific Ocean, in the rarely visited depths of the Mariana Trench, in a titanium, so super strong metal, submersible called a Triton.
Thank you for explaining that, but also what the four extremes are. I had no idea.
No, I didn't, but there you go.
That's great. Vanessa, how about you?
Well, I found out, as if honeybees weren't lovable enough already for making honey, apparently they sleep for 6 to 8 hours a day, so they're very like humans in that regard.
Oh, wow. Good for them. I kind of respect them even more now for having a good old nap. Ben, what have you learned?
I learned that there is a super cool bunch of cops in Karachi, which is a city in Pakistan, who race around on inline skates or rollerblades, if you prefer, to catch crooks. So sometimes a thief might run through an alleyway and they can't get the police cars down there. So they just send the rollerblade cops after them. They look really cool, and I'm very glad I am not a thief in Karachi.
Rollerblade Cops, that's a TV show I would definitely watch.
Better than The A-Team, I would say.
Probably. Right, now it's time for Real or Rubbish. This is when I get to hear a story and try and figure out whether it's true or false. So Ben, what do you have for me this week?
So Bex, you've probably not done much travelling to foreign countries in the past year, but maybe you would if you lived on one island and then there was another island just 3 miles away that was actually a totally different country. But there is a little bit of a complication here, because the two islands have a 21-hour time difference. It's the Diomede Islands in the Bering Strait. That's part of the Pacific Ocean that separates Russia and the US. So the larger island is named Big Diomede. That's on the Russian side. The smaller one, Little Diomede. Bet you couldn't guess that. That's on the US side. They're 3 miles apart, but one of them is nearly an entire day ahead of the other. Now, does this sound true? Are we messing with the clocks in your brain?
Oh man, I love stuff like this. Because I do know that, isn't that fact that Alaska is kind of closer to Russia than the US? Is that right?
Alaska is closer to Russia than the main continental US, where yes, most of the states are, yes.
So in a way, I can kind of understand this happening, but 21 hours difference, that just seems ridiculous if they're only three miles apart.
It does seem ridiculous, doesn't it? Is it real or is it rubbish, Bex? I'm putting the pressure on you here. I already know the answer.
First impression is it seems a bit mad, but also one of those things is just a kind of weird quirk of the world and has happened. So I will have a think about that. And if you're listening and you've not read your copy of the magazine yet, feel free to make your guess before the end of the show. So now it's time for our three big stories from this week. First up, Vanessa, what have you found out about?
Well, the big story this week is that I had my COVID jab last night, in fact. Yes, but apparently that's not entirely of national importance. It is hugely important to me. I actually feel okay, if anyone's interested. But I've got, on the subject of hope, kind of related, I've got some lovely news about people, young people, inspiring hope and being rewarded for it. UK Youth is a charity that supports young people in the UK in all sorts of ways. It has links with more than 7,000 organisations. Now, that might sound a bit vague, but that's because the charity works across so many different areas. And it links up members with networks, trainings, workshops, campaigns. In other words, whatever a young person is trying to do, UK Youth probably has some way of helping you. Anyway, one of its programmes is the Inspiring Hope Awards, which rewards young people who are working to help others. Now, I am so glad I was not on the judging panel because it sounds absolutely impossible to choose. But they did it. They whittled down 355 nominations to a shortlist of six for each award. And there are seven awards in all, so that's quickfire test here. Correct, 42 on the shortlist. And they reward all sorts of things, including inspirational leadership, a youth organisation, creativity, inclusivity, lots of things. Anyway, the awards went to, among others, Kaz Nathan, who won for her work helping young people living in a hostel because they're homeless. Alex Gerpenaar, who supports young people in lots of ways, but particularly in reducing serious violence. The National Youth Orchestra won for its Mighty River project, which was inspired by Black Lives Matter, and it works to increase diversity in the performance of classical music, which is sort of felt to be quite elitist in some ways. And We Belong, a charity We Belong, won for its work as the UK's first migrant-led organisation campaigning for the rights of young migrants. Now, these people who've had to leave their home country in search of a better life. And We Belong's aim is to use their own personal experience of being a migrant to explain what it's really like. Because often people are unkind about people coming to live in this country and they get treated unfairly. And Tashi Tahir, who works for We Belong, spoke to the Week Junior and she said it feels incredible that in our first year as an organisation, our work is being recognised. So it's just, I just think it's very uplifting to hear about so many people doing this fantastic work to help others, and they're not looking for recognition or fame, they're just doing it for the sake of making other people's lives better.
It is really nice to hear some good news stories, because I think right now we're still, you know, getting a few bad news stories through, so it's quite uplifting to hear these.
Yes, and that I got my jab yesterday.
Congratulations on that. That's the biggest news. That's the big one. Dave, tell me, what have you been finding out about this week?
Well, I've been finding out all about Sutton Hoo. In 1939, Edith Pretty, a landowner at Sutton Hoo, Suffolk, asked an archaeologist called Basil Brown to investigate the largest of several Anglo-Saxon burial mounds on her land. The Anglo-Saxons were people who lived in Britain from around 410 to 1066 AD. And Basil made one of the most amazing archaeological discoveries of all time. Beneath the mound was the imprint of a 27-metre-long ship. Now, the wood from the ship had dissolved into the soil, but the imprint remained. Brown and Pretty had discovered the most impressive Anglo-Saxon burial site ever found in Europe. And at its centre, they found a burial chamber packed with treasures such as gold jewellery, silverware, shields, a purse containing gold coins, and most famously, an ornate iron helmet, which you can see on the front cover of this week's issue. In fact, the Sutton Hoo helmet is one of the most breathtaking treasures they found. It took years to carefully reconstruct from the shattered pieces in the earth. The buried ship was actually a coffin for a very important person, as back then it was believed that this was the best way to make sure the person reached the afterlife. No human remains were actually found in the ship, and it's thought that they had dissolved over time into the earth. The body would have been laid in a chamber at the centre of the ship and the treasures laid out around it. And each object showed the person's power and wealth. And the objects at Sutton Hoo suggest it's the grave of a very wealthy warrior, possibly a king. Now, the discovery at Sutton Hoo was so important because it transformed our understanding of the Anglo-Saxon period. It showed that early medieval society was a vibrant place, capable of remarkable artistic skill. It shows that the world of great halls, glittering treasures, and formidable warriors described in Anglo-Saxon poetry was not a myth, but in fact, absolutely true. And Edith Pretty donated the find from Sutton Hoo to the British Museum in London. And it's one of the museum's most cherished collections and has around 5,000 items. And I've been to Sutton Hoo, and I remember wondering at the time where the actual exhibition was, because essentially you're kind of walking around a few large mounds of earth, not much to see. Everything that was discovered is in the British Museum. There's never an actual ship, just the imprint in the earth. However, the visitor centre was completely transformed a few years back, and now you get a real sense of the importance of these incredible royal burial mounds, including a 27-metre replica of the ship. So I'm going to go back and check it out.
It sounds incredible. How was it for you picking the pictures to go in the magazine? Were you quite excited by that?
There's a few standout ones, which you'll see in the issue in the All About, and the Iron Helmet especially. There was a recreated one, but we've got the real one. It just looks absolutely amazing.
Oh, brilliant stuff. I'll look out for it. And now, Ben, over to you. What have you been finding out about this week?
Well, I don't want to pick sides, right? But there aren't many birds cooler than flamingos, in my opinion. They're so distinctive. They're water birds with long necks, long legs, and, of course, their unusual pink feathers. And I once stayed in an eco park in Mexico, and there were flamingos everywhere, and it was just wonderful seeing them each morning. And right now, the citizens of Mumbai in Western India are seeing tens of thousands of flamingos. They've been arriving on freshwater lakes and wetlands in the area, and it's not a one-off. Happens every year around this time, and tourists flock to the area because just the sheer number of birds, it makes it look like the lakes have turned pink. So it's quite a sight. There are 6 species of flamingo, and they live on several continents. Before you ask, I don't know which ones I saw in Mexico, but the colourful Mumbai ones are a mix of the greater and lesser flamingo species. Sadly, wildlife experts consider the lesser flamingo to be under threat because some of its favourite lakes are in danger from human activity and from droughts. So that's when an area goes for long periods without rain. The wetlands of Western India, though, provide a really good feeding and breeding ground for them. Most settle in Thane Creek, which is an inlet home to around 200 species of birds. Local officials have declared the area a flamingo sanctuary in order to protect their visitors, which is great news.
So, Ben, tell me, where have these flamingos come from?
Well, most have come from regions in northwestern India, so within the country, and they're thought to make the annual trip south to escape from cold weather, as you can imagine. Others, though, make longer journeys. They've come from Afghanistan, Iran, Israel, Pakistan, even a few as far away as France. The birds haven't always come to Mumbai, though. This is relatively new. They only started migrating there in the 1980s and 1990s. I'm sure if they're well looked after in this new sanctuary, though, they're going to come back for many more years. I'd love to see it.
Lovely stuff. Thanks, Ben. Anna, while I have you, there is another question I've got to ask you as well. I believe you've got a big new competition right now.
Oh, we do. It is big and it's fantastic. It's with the Guild of Food Writers. And I don't know about you, Bex, but I think food is great. In fact, food is my favourite thing to eat. And that's why we've teamed up with the Guild of Food Writers for the Food Writer of the Year competition. And you could be the Young Food Writer of the Year. So if you're a keen writer and you love food, then this is obviously the competition for you. If you want to be in with a chance of winning, all you have to do is write a short story around the theme of food discovery. And you can approach that however you like. It could be a new food that you tried, or it could be you went on some adventure somewhere, you discovered something and there was a meal that you had when you were there. Up to you. There are 3 age categories with set word counts for each. So if you're 10 or under, you can write up to 250 words. 11 to 14-year-olds, then it's up to 500 words. 15 to 18s, they can write up to 750 words. There are some great prizes for the winners, including just the glory of being Young Food Writer of the Year, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. But you'll also get an invite to the Guild of Food Writers virtual tea party, a £100 book token. And for the 10 and under and 11 to 14 year old category winners, you might get your story featured in the Week Junior, which is, let's face it, the big prize. To find out more about how to enter, visit theweekjunior.co.uk/food discovery.
Oh man, that sounds so awesome. Those prizes are brilliant.
I know, they are so good. And when we did the virtual tea party with the most recent winners, it was fantastic to talk to them, hear them talk about food and why they love food and the things that have inspired them. So I think this year's is going to be bigger and better. So good luck to everybody listening who's going to enter.
Yeah, big good luck for everyone. Right now it's time for our debate, the big debate, in fact. And this week we're asking whether people should watch TV with the subtitles on. Who can tell me a bit more?
Well, that's me this week. And, you know, it's a good question. Why on earth would you want to watch telly with subtitles on? Well, experts have suggested that they improve young people's reading skills. So subtitles are the text at the bottom of the screen that are the written version of what people on screen are saying. And subtitles are already used by people with hearing impairments. But an organisation called Turn On The Subtitles has been set up by parents because reading subtitles while watching a telly programme dramatically improves reading ability, apparently. And as the average child in the UK watches almost 12 hours of television a week, that's a lot of possible reading practice that could change a child's life. However, is that just an excuse to watch more telly instead of reading a book? Let the battle commence.
All right, well, this one is going to be Ben versus Dave. Ben can go first, as is traditional. You both know, you've got a minute. Ben is arguing for the motion, so whenever you're ready, take it away.
I love reading books, but not everyone does. I accept that. We're all different. However, there are very few people who don't enjoy watching TV. Well, guess what, Bex? Switching the subtitles on when watching TV is like activating a cheat code in a video game. It requires no extra effort, but can really pay off. It helps you learn loads of new words or master tricky spelling, or for younger children, will help them learn to read. You can even do it as a family, unlike reading a book, which most of us would probably just read by ourselves, perhaps tucked up in bed at night. Obviously, I'm not suggesting watching rubbish TV all day. That's a terrible idea. But why not, when watching the great shows you love, just put the subtitles on? You'll get better without even realizing it. The Turn On The Subtitles campaign's research shows that someone's eyes inescapably and automatically read subtitles while watching TV. This isn't about ditching books for TV. It's like adding extra fun reading into your day. The question isn't why you would want to do that. The question is, why would we deliberately avoid trying to make our brains better? Subtitles are the cheat code we should all be using to gain an advantage.
Wow, lovely stuff under a minute, and roping in the video game debate there, the cheat code thing. Very interesting. So, Dave, it's up to you to argue against Ben. Whenever you're ready, take it away.
Okay, well, I don't think you should watch TV with the subtitles on, especially if you're doing it as a substitute for reading. You read books and you watch TV. The power of the book is that everything is left to your imagination. You can really dwell on the words and the story as you read. In fact, you start to make your own visual, in a sense. If we start to read television instead of books, then all the magic of a proper book will start to disappear. It's been said that parents and teachers think they are tricking children into learning to read, when in fact, children are tricking parents and teachers into letting them watch more TV. Watching a TV show is better if you're not distracted by having to follow the words on the screen. I've personally noticed spelling mistakes or bad grammar in some of the shows that I've seen that did have the subtitles switched on. I'm sure it might help some children to read, which is great, of course, but I think that increased screen time would be a mistake. Besides, reading the words at the bottom of the screen ruins the viewing experience. So it's not only bad for books, but it's bad for TV as well.
Wow, quite a debate there. Vanessa, what do you reckon?
To get personal here for a minute, I am personal and delightful. I had an ear infection a few months ago. Delicious, delicious. So I couldn't hear a thing. And so I did have to put the subtitles on telly because I love telly. And I have to say, it didn't particularly impair the experience. So I would say yes to subtitles. If it improves your reading, why not? And if they're really annoying, just switch them off again.
Interesting. I've got to say, whenever I have subtitles on, I find myself so distracted by them. that I can't actually focus at all on what I'm watching, and it kind of ruins it a bit for me. So I'll be interested to see what the listeners think of this. So let us know what you think of this week's debate by responding to the poll at theweekjunior.co.uk/polls. Or email hello@theweekjunior.co.uk with a video clip explaining which side of the debate you support and why.
Ben, could I just check, was that Otto joining in the conversation there in the background?
Yes, it was. That was him downstairs. He doesn't have his own microphone, but he can bark loud enough. I don't know if he was barking at the postman or just some wind or just the look in someone's eye that he didn't really like through the window. It could be anything. That's one of the beautiful things about having a dog. You never really know what they're thinking.
Surely you'd have a microbone.
Oh, well,
oh, very
congratulations
good.
Very on good. Thinking up that joke.
No, I'm happy with that. That was a great one. Because speaking of dogs, last week on the podcast, we debated whether dogs are better than cats. What a result. It was close. In the end, 51% of you said dogs were the best, narrowly beating the 49% who prefer cats. So here's some of your comments.
Well, the dog lovers turned out to make their case. Evie emailed us to tell us, in my opinion, dogs are better than cats because of their loyalty. Most dogs are devoted to their owners, but cats don't really care. Added to this, cats are more independent, meaning they don't develop as much of an understanding or friendship.
It's a good point, but not everyone agreed. Allegra sent us this voice note.
Hi, I'm Allegra, and I think that though I love dogs, I am a cat person. I have two little cats who are 8 months old and are absolutely adorable. And although they can be grumpy, when they're cuddly, it is all the more special. Go cats! Although I do love dogs too.
Thanks, Allegra.
I'm very glad that dogs won this, and here's what some of our pop jammers thought. One wrote, dogs and cats have very different personalities, so it depends what you're looking for. If you want a cuddly, calm friend, cats are the one. But if you're looking for an active buddy, a dog would be great. Another listener told us, I think both are okay, but I prefer rabbits.
The hidden third option. So remember, this is your chance to get involved. Grab a grown-up and record a video telling us what you think of this week's debate. Then send it in to us at hello@theweekjunior.co.uk and we could play it out on next week's show. Just a bit of time, I think, to reveal our real or rubbish story. Ben, can you remind me what it was, please?
Yes, there are two small islands, the Diomede Islands in the Bering Straits, which is part of the Pacific Ocean separating Russia and the US. The larger island, Big Diomede, is on the Russian side. The smaller island, Little Diomede, is on the US side. Separated by 3 miles, but there's a 21-hour time difference between the two. What do you think, Bex? Real, rubbish, what?
Now, my geography is very bad, which may become apparent in what I'm about to say. But, so, I know the Earth is round, and time changes depending where you go. And it's got to start and stop somewhere, right? I know GMT is in London. Like, that's where we are. Like, England has its own time zone. This is really hard. This is messing with my brain. The idea...
No, I wouldn't have guessed. Yeah, you sound like you're all over this, Bex.
No, I think knowing that the Earth is round and that time changes wherever you are, I think you're on pretty sure ground there, Bex. Keep going.
Thanks, Vanessa.
I wouldn't have guessed you knew that, I'll be honest.
It does sound like I'm reading something from Google, doesn't it? 21 hours is a big difference if there's only 3 miles in between. But time has to start and stop somewhere, right?
It feels like it's stopped here.
I wish
here.
I was Doctor... Right. As you can tell, I have no idea. But I'm gonna say it's real. I'm gonna say it's one of those quirks of planet Earth, which is round, that it starts and finishes in weirdly the same place, which means there is a 21-hour difference in time.
So 21 hours, but not 24 hours then, yeah?
Ben, don't confuse me even more. Like, I've only just about made up my mind. Yeah, I'm gonna say it's real. Yeah.
Okay. All right, well. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we've got the Earth is round and this is real. Let's get a drum roll, please. Well, listeners, mark your calendars because Bex has got one right. The islands
yes!
do have a 21-hour time difference. And it's because of something called the International Dateline, which is an imaginary line in the Pacific Ocean that marks the boundary between one calendar day and the next. So Bex was trying to work through this, and basically she got there with, it's right, there are these lines on the map that say, you know, the UK is 1 hour away from France, for example, and there happens to be a line that means that it's 21 hours between these two little islands because they're in different continents.
Wow, I'm so happy I got it right, but also so happy that my terrible kind of showing my workings actually helped.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, that always will get you a little bit of extra credit, even if you get the answer wrong. The fact that you've managed to explain your ability to know other things. So congratulations. That is one of the more impressive answers you've given. Although it did take 21 hours, I think, to get there.
Well, I got there in the end. That's it for the Week Junior Show this week. Drop us a comment on PopJam at The Week Junior or email hello@theweekjunior.co.uk. And don't forget to rate, review and subscribe or follow us wherever it is you get your podcasts. Bye!
If you want to get your hands on a copy of The Week Junior magazine, we're offering a 6-week free trial. To get yours, head over to dennismags.co.uk/TheWeekJunior and use the code PODCAST.